My name is Brian Paul. If we haven't met, I'm a partner at Ice Miller. I am the president of the local lawyers chapter of the Federalist Society. For years now, America has been embroiled in a battle over homosexuality. In recent years, that battle was primarily, in years past, a cultural and political one. The principal issue was how we as a society should view homosexuality and treat homosexuals. Now, as homosexuality has become more accepted by the culture at large, the battle has become a legal one. And at the heart of this legal battle is the very definition of marriage. Pending now before the U.S. Supreme Court are two cases that, for better or worse, may well decide once and for all whether the government, be it state or federal, can, as a matter of equal protection, limit the definition of marriage to the union of a man and a woman. Here today to discuss this controversial issue is Professor George Dent. Since 1990, Professor Dent has been a professor of law at Case Western Reserve, where he writes extensively on law and religion. For example, in a Law Review article entitled Civil Rights for Whom? Gay Rights versus Religious Freedom, he argued for the right of people of faith to express their views on moral issues and to act according to their conscience without being charged with violating anti-discrimination laws. And in several other articles, including the one that I sent along with the email inviting you to this event, Professor Dent has defended the traditional definition of marriage as an important institution for children. Please welcome Professor George Dent.
Thank you, Brian, and thank all of you. Thanks to all of you for inviting me, and I hope I justify your faith in me in having invited me. I'll talk today, as Brian said, about the two marriage cases currently before the Supreme Court. In U.S. against Windsor, the first, Windsor had married her lesbian partner in Canada. They then returned home to New York, which did not then recognize gay marriage. When the partner died, the Internal Revenue Service assessed the estate tax. Windsor sued, challenging the constitutionality of the Defense of Marriage Act because it denied her the marital exemption. Section 3 of DOMA limits marriage to one woman and one man for purposes of federal law, regardless of state law. The Second Circuit struck down Section 3 of DOMA, and it called it, quote, an unprecedented breach of longstanding deference to federalism that singles out same-sex marriage as the only inconsistency among many in state law that requires a federal rule to achieve uniformity. And it then called DOMA also an unprecedented intrusion into an area of traditional state regulation. Well, the second point is clearly untrue. DOMA expressly retains the right of the states to define marriage. It only defines marriage for purposes of federal law. And the first point made by the Second Circuit is also false. Congress has previously disregarded the state's definition of marriage and adopted a federal definition in a few cases. And even if this were the first time that Congress had done this, clearly Congress is free to do so, and especially because the magnitude of the problems posed by state imposition of gay marriage dwarfs the problems raised by any prior state inconsistencies. So for those reasons, the court should uphold Section 3 of DOMA. By the way, about the use of the word marriage, Abe Lincoln, who grew up here in Indiana, once asked, how many legs does a dog have if you call a tail a leg? And the answer was, four. You can call a tail a leg, but that doesn't make it so. It's still a tail, and the dog still has only four legs. Ditto for the term gay marriage. I mean, in my opinion, you can call it that, but that doesn't make it so. In the second case before the court, Hollingsworth against Perry, California had always followed the traditional definition of marriage as between one woman and one man. The California Supreme Court then held that this definition violated the state constitution and mandated recognition of gay marriage. California citizens immediately began a campaign that at the very next state election approved Proposition 8, which amended the state constitution to restore the traditional definition. Despite Proposition 8, California law still recognized civil unions between homosexuals, which had exactly the same material rights as marriage, differing only in the name. Nonetheless, some homosexual couples sued, and the Ninth Circuit, which purported not to decide whether the federal constitution requires recognition of gay marriage, instead held Prop 8 unconstitutional because it deprived homosexuals of a right they already had. Of course, that right had only lasted for a few months or a year or so. And because it amended not a statute, but the state constitution, which erected an unusual barrier to those seeking recognition of gay marriage, a barrier not faced by other groups seeking to enact their programs into law. Now, the court's reasoning here also is wrong. First of all, Prop 8 denied gay couples no substantive rights. Again, it was only the label of marriage that they were denied. The Ninth Circuit said that this was an important right because of the historic significance of that label. I'll discuss that more a little later. More important, though, if recognition of gay marriage is not mandated by the federal constitution, then a state that has instituted it ought to be able to repeal it, especially in a case like this, where recognition was first imposed by a court and then repealed by the people. As for the rationale that Proposition 8 imposed an unusual barrier, Justice Scalia made the obvious point several years ago in Romer against Evans, that all constitutional clauses pose special barriers to those who want to eliminate those laws. That's the whole purpose of a constitutional provision, is to make it more difficult to change. However, the majority of the court rejected this argument in Romer, so I suppose it might do so here as well. That would result in imposing gay marriage in California, but at least immediately, not in any other state. By the way, in both these cases, the relevant government officials, to their shame, in my opinion, refused to defend the laws in question. Now, as an aside, ask yourself, what is the meaning of the rule of law when the president or a governor can nullify laws he doesn't like just by refusing to defend them? Imagine the uproar. I was told that there were a lot of people walking around here with AR-15s today. Imagine if a governor or president said, I'm just not going to defend the constitutionality of our state or our federal government's gun control regulations, or the environmental laws, or the civil rights laws, or the tax laws. I'm just not going to defend them. Again, what's left of the rule of law? So in both these cases, other people stepped in to defend the laws. So there's a question whether they have standing. I doubt that the Supreme Court would allow these laws to be struck down just because no one has standing. And again, in effect, saying that the executive is free to nullify any laws he doesn't like just by refusing to defend them. But of course, I'm not certain what the court will do. Now, the big issue, of course, in these cases is whether there is a good reason for the traditional definition of marriage. Now, of course, as to what marriage means to each of us individually, that's an individual matter. For some people, it's a sacred relationship. For others, perhaps something to be avoided at all cost. But by the way, conservatives here, I think, make a mistake, and often make a mistake, of letting the left dictate the terms of discussion. So you often hear about a ban on gay marriage. And, of course, most Americans recoil at words like ban, prohibit, forbid. But, of course, there is no ban on gay marriage. Homosexuals are free to have a wedding, to consider themselves married, and to be so considered by any private entity that wants to. There's no ban. All they can't do is to coerce an unwilling electorate or individuals to honor their relationships as identical to the real marriages that have always been venerated in all societies. When you phrase it that way, you see that the cause of freedom is more on our side than on theirs, or my side anyway. I'm assuming many of you agree with me, but I suppose I could be wrong about that. So the question here is the legal definition of marriage. And I'll begin to discuss that by quoting a notorious, redneck, illiterate, bigoted fundamentalist who said, quote, "It is through children alone that sexual relations become of importance to society and worthy to be taken cognizance of by a legal institution." Okay, I lied. It wasn't a redneck. That was Bertrand Russell, one of the great philosophers and mathematicians of the 20th century, an atheist, a socialist, an advocate of free love, of women's rights, and of gay rights. But in this case, he was correct. Every society throughout history has recognized marriage. And although its customs have varied in many ways, three features are constant. First, marriage is always a public matter. It is never just a private arrangement between the parties. Second, whatever else it is concerned with, property, political alliances, marriage is always centrally concerned with the conception, bearing, and raising of children. And third, which is really just a corollary of the second, is that marriage is always between female and male. But for a very few, very recent exceptions, there is no precedent for same-sex marriage. Anthropologists tell us that given the tremendous diversity of human cultures, in the rare cases where we find the same practice in every society, there probably is a good reason for it. The reason here is not hard to fathom. Society clearly has a crucial interest in the raising of children. Children are its future. But children can't fend for themselves. They need adult care. Now, our instincts alone incline women and men to form pair bonds and to care for their biological children. So the best child care generally comes in the natural family. That is, a woman, a man, and their biological children, with the woman and a man in a committed low-conflict relationship. However, the instincts of parents alone do not assure optimal child care. So society has an important interest in promoting the creation and preservation of the natural family as a way of promoting good child care. But the means for society to do this are quite limited. Children, small children at least, need constant care. But you can't put a cop next to the parents 24 hours a day to make sure that they're doing a good job. So the best solution to this problem, followed until recently in every society, is to encourage marriage between a woman and a man who may be in a sexual relationship and therefore may conceive children. To some extent, this encouragement is material, like special tax treatment. However, much of the encouragement comes from the normative or expressive function of law, that is, the role of law in expressing social values and in encouraging social norms to move in particular directions. Now, for those of you who are real pragmatic and realists, you might say, is that just a fantasy? No, it is real and significant. Sociologists have documented many instances where changes in the law have helped to change people's attitudes. Just consider, for example, in the last few decades, changes in American attitudes towards smoking and drunk driving. And recall also that the Ninth Circuit in Hollingsworth specifically stressed the importance of the label marriage apart from any material consequences, saying that in itself, the deprivation of the label itself, was important because of the expressive significance of the legal definition of marriage. Now, has this combination that society has used, that has evolved, the combination of human instinct and legal support worked? Absolutely. There are mountains of evidence, really, it's incontestable, that by every measure, school performance, physical and mental health, obedience to the law, etc., children fare best when raised by their married biological parents. Even cohabiting biological parents do less well. Now, some critics say that marriage is not the cause of these advantages. Correlation is not causation. They say rather it's because the better people tend to marry. Well, as a married person, I'm flattered. But that critique clearly is wrong. Even when you adjust for education and other factors like that, the parents' level of education and such, marriage is still better for kids. Consider, for example, that married men make more money. Well, why is that? Because marriage tends to cause men to be more serious. Some have been known to make drastic changes, like cutting back from a six-pack a day to a case a week. Kidding aside, marriage signifies a commitment that causes us to take our obligations more seriously. So it is to be expected that the biological parents would do a better job of caring for their children if they're married. So society has good reasons to promote the natural, the biological family through marriage. Even if the Supreme Court applies heightened scrutiny, which I think it should not, but even if it did, the traditional definition of marriage should easily survive because marriage serves important social interests that cannot be achieved by other acceptable means. Okay, but the other side denies that marriage serves any such purpose. Well, if that is right, what is the explanation for the existence of the traditional definition of marriage as being solely between male and female? Again, this marriage has been celebrated in every human society throughout history. So if the other side is right, then the only reason for marriage, dating back to before the beginnings of civilization and possibly even before the beginnings of the species Homo sapiens, the only reason for this institution has been to stigmatize homosexuals. Can that be right? As a matter of fact, I'm not even aware of anyone who, prior to about 50 years ago, even argued for same-sex marriage. Even the Emperor Hadrian, who was, you know, openly homosexual, when his young lover committed suicide by walking into the sea, Hadrian told the Senate to deify him, which of course the Senate immediately did. So Hadrian was not in the closet, but he never bothered to institute gay marriage. Why not? Because he thought, perhaps, that marriage was about something else, like children, and wasn't really relevant to his relationships. So that should be the end of the discussion, but let me tackle some contrary arguments that are made, beginning with the slogans, marriage equality and right to marry. Those are triple or possibly quadruple baloney. First, suppose a 50-year-old moves to this country after having lived in England, Ireland, Japan, becomes a citizen, and invokes equal protection. He says, now, the people who want to drive on the right side of the road get to drive on the right side of the road. I want to drive on the left side of the road. So equal protection means that I get to drive on the left side of the road. No, that's not what equal protection means. Equal protection means that everybody plays by the same rules, not that everybody gets to make up his own rules. Now, what about, however, and of course, there's no law that says homosexuals can't marry. It says they can. They can marry a person of the other sex. Now, they don't want to do that, just as perhaps somebody who's moved here from another country might not want to drive on the right side of the road. But, you know, that's up to you. You can do it the way it's prescribed or not do it at all, but you can't make up your own rules. All right, but what about Loving against Virginia, where the Supreme Court struck down laws forbidding interracial marriages? That's different in several ways. First, the anti-miscegenation laws were a sharp departure from Jewish law, canon law, Roman law, English common law. In other words, from all the sources of American law. In effect, those laws, anti-miscegenation laws, were a heresy. And essentially, the Supreme Court said, stop the heresy and return to orthodoxy. I would be very happy to have the Supreme Court apply that same principle in the marriage cases now before it. Second, the anti-miscegenation laws involved race, the central issue over which the Civil War was fought, and for which the 14th Amendment was adopted. For that reason, the Supreme Court has long and properly applied strict scrutiny to racial classifications, but not elsewhere. By the way, I hope the Supreme Court will continue to apply strict scrutiny in the racial preferences case, Fisher against University of Texas, which is now before, but not elsewhere. And third, when the Loving case was decided, less than a third of the states even had anti-miscegenation laws, and those were rarely enforced. The Lovings themselves had to jump up and down for a long time and shout, "We're violating the law, we're violating the law," before they finally provoked some rural prosecutor who was dumb enough to sue them. Now, whatever Americans thought in 1867, by 1967, they had reached a consensus that the anti-miscegenation laws had no rational basis. They were really dead-letter laws, and all the Supreme Court did was to throw out some dead-letter laws. By the way, the same reasoning could justify the invalidation of criminal sodomy laws in Lawrence against Texas. Very few states still had such laws, and those were rarely and arbitrarily enforced. It was only when some local sheriff wanted to use the statute to harass somebody that those laws were invoked. By contrast, 40 states still limit marriage to a woman and a man, and over 30 have confirmed that definition by referenda in recent years, and those laws are fully enforced. So Loving and Lawrence are both completely different from the present cases. The marriage equality slogan is also baloney because it's hypocritical. If equal protection forbids the heterosexual requirement of marriage, what about all the other requirements, like monogamy and non-consanguinity? If two women can marry, why can't three women marry? And if two unrelated men can marry, why can't two brothers marry? Can't be a concern about birth defects there. And what does marriage equality, you always hear the LGBT community, what does marriage equality mean for bisexuals? Check me on my arithmetic here, but I think that means you need at least four people, doesn't it? And actually, is this strictly hypothetical? I just read, I think it was two days ago, that in the Netherlands, where they recognize same-sex marriage, three people have sued, the two guys and a woman who want to be married. And the guys say they're bisexual, and their sexual orientation requires a marriage of more than, recognition of a marriage of more than two people. And by the way, I've argued and debated this issue many times, and I've said, how are these matters different? And the other side always says they're different, but has never even given me an even plausible explanation of why these are different. So it seems obvious to me that the cry for recognition of gay marriage is hypocritical. If that comes in, all these others have to come in as well. And it's doubly hypocritical. If the principle is to treat everyone the same, then government can't favor married people over those who live alone or who live together but don't want to marry. And indeed, if we abolish the traditional definition of marriage, it's hard to see what justification there is for favoring marriage at all. Does society have a good reason to say that it's better for homosexuals to marry? Homosexuals disagree among themselves about the desirability of marriage. How the hell would the rest of us know what's better for them? Why should the government put its thumb on the scale and say it's better to live one way rather than another? Again, as Bertrand Russell said, the only reason why society has reason to care about it, this is because of the possibility of the conception of children. Third, equal protection, again, does not mean everyone is treated the same. All laws create distinctions. Equal protection simply means that the government has to have decent reasons for treating people differently. And as I've said, there are very strong reasons for limiting marriage to a woman and a man, specifically to promote the natural family as the best milieu for children. But this claim then meets the reply, all right, but what's the harm? What's the harm in recognizing gay marriage? First, at least for constitutional purposes, that's the wrong question. What would be the harm in lowering the voting age to 17? I don't know, maybe none. And would it change the results in a lot of elections? But Congress must draw lines, and it can reasonably distinguish between the potentially generative union of a woman and a man and the intrinsically sterile relationship between two people of the same sex without having to prove that including the latter would be harmful. Second, even for legislative purposes, the burden should be on the proponents of gay marriage to prove that its recognition would not cause any harm. And this they can't do because until recently no society had tried it. Now, in another 25 or 30 years, maybe experience in the Netherlands or elsewhere will permit such proof. I doubt it, but I guess that could happen. But until then, there's no possibility of making such a case. And third, as I already suggested, the Supreme Court cannot in principle stop with imposing gay marriage. If it does so, it must in principle also mandate polygamy and consanguineous or incestuous marriage, or more reasonably, forbid legal preference for marriage, however defined. A related criticism. A distinction was once drawn between Marxism, which however wrong could be very sophisticated, and what was called vulgar Marxism, which was a clumsy wooden application of class struggle analysis. Well, some people, including some Federalists who I think should know better, embrace, in this case anyway, what I would call vulgar libertarianism. Thinking to apply the principle of small government, they argue that government should get out of the marriage business. Just, you know, smaller government? Well, one way to do is get government out of the marriage business. Even on its own terms, That's foolish. Because ending legal recognition of marriage will require more government, not less. Think, which families require the least intrusion from government and which require the most? Intact married families require the least. It's when marriage breaks down or is never formed to begin with that government involvement is more often necessary. Things like figuring out who has custody of and financial responsibility for the children. If you want less government, you should work to increase government support for marriage, like quadrupling the child tax credit, I think would be a good idea. And fourth, even if we could stop with recognition of monogamous gay marriage, it's likely that there would be harm. Again, marriage is society's way of promoting the natural family. And it does this largely through its expressive function. Again, you can't put a cop there to watch 24 hours a day. So we encourage marriage by the expressive function of the law. Recognizing gay marriage would completely change the message. It would say to the world, we consider an inherently sterile homosexual relationship to be just as valuable as a heterosexual relationship. The ability of a woman and a man to create human life is of no social value whatever. It would say, marriage is no longer a child-centered relationship. In the eyes of the law, marriage exists for the gratification of adults. We already have a growing number of couples creating children without marrying, much to the detriment of the children and of society. Recognizing gay marriage would abet that trend. Now, I know that many gays have issues with their families, but whatever you think of your parents, they did create you. Our society has always held that human life has great intrinsic value. If you agree with that, it seems logically undeniable that the union of a woman and a man, which can create human life, has a substantial value that is lacking in a relationship that is intrinsically sterile. Indeed, some fans of gay marriage promote it precisely because they think it will damage traditional marriage. They say that gay marriage is, quote, these are quotes, subversive, will introduce an implicit revolt against the institution into its very heart, and may culminate in the fading away of marriage. The law of marriage has always served to protect children. But advocates of gay marriage argue gay couples are already raising children in growing numbers. Why shouldn't those children get the benefits of marriage? First of all, it's uncertain whether giving the label marriage to gay couples will help those children. Again, as Lincoln said, you can call a tail a leg, but that doesn't make it so. Second, no gay couple creates children. They can acquire children only through adoption. Conception is a biological process. Adoption is a legal process. That is, in the case of adoption, the law is already there. So why not address the needs of these children through adoption, which is well suited for the job, rather than distorting the definition of marriage, which is not well suited to that job? Third, recall the expressive function of marriage. Recognizing gay marriage sends the message that it's just as good for children as real marriage. But that's not true. Sociologist Lauren Marks at Louisiana State showed that the studies purporting to prove that children raised by gay couples fare just as well as children raised by their married biological parents, those studies were not valid. And University of Texas sociologist Mark Regnera showed that by most standard measures, the studies we have show that children raised by gay couples fare worse than children raised in the natural family. Now, for many of you, probably will respond to that finding by saying, well, duh. But it made news because so many gay activists had claimed the contrary. Third, By mandating equal treatment for gay marriage, the Supreme Court would also alter adoption law. The loss of a biological parent has always been considered a tragedy. But every child raised by a gay couple has been deprived of at least one parent. The gay movement responds by claiming that this is irrelevant. Every family is as good as every other family. Now, some of you younger members of the audience might not realize this, but the spiritual, "Sometimes I Feel Like a Motherless Child," that was supposed to be a sad song. Now we're told, oh, you're special. You don't have a mother, but you have two fathers. You're special. Or maybe you just don't have a father. You just have a mother. But every family is special. If you think I'm making this up, just go read Heather Has Two Mommies. Not on a full stomach, I would suggest. Unlike my friend Lynn Wardle at Brigham Young and some others, I don't think that gay couples should be absolutely forbidden to adopt. There are children who are starving and abandoned in various parts of the world, and they clearly would be better off with a middle-class gay couple in America than where they are now. But to deliberately plan to deprive a child of a mother or a father strikes me as child abuse. And this is empirically confirmed by example in the attitudes of children conceived by sperm donation, who report that they feel keenly the absence of their fathers and want to know who they are and have contact with them. A Supreme Court mandate for equal treatment of gay couples would probably prevent legislatures from regulating sperm donation and other forms of artificial reproduction. A related issue, on which I co-authored an amicus brief to the Supreme Court in these cases. Suppose the Supreme Court decides that sexual orientation is a suspect classification. What effect will that have on religious freedom? Imagine you're a government official charged with hiring someone who will work with other employees and members of the public. You're looking at one resume, and it's looking very good until you come to the end and you see that the person is a member of the Ku Klux Klan. What would your reaction be? Well, at the best, you probably want to check very carefully and more likely would say, that's too much risk of trouble. Let's not go there. Now imagine you have an applicant who is a Catholic, observant Jew, Muslim, or traditional Protestant. Well, if sexual orientation is a suspect classification as race is, you probably have to treat the applicant the same as a member of the Ku Klux Klan. The applicant presumably believes that homosexual acts are sins, just as the Klansman thinks that certain races are inferior. The Catholic or Klansman may promise not to discriminate, but even just voicing his views could cause trouble. Better not go there. This is not a fanciful horror story. A Hewlett-Packard employee, these are just a few of many cases. It would take me a couple of hours more if I were just to talk about these cases. A Hewlett-Packard employee was fired for posting passages of the Bible in his cubicle. The Ninth Circuit dismissed his civil rights suit for religious discrimination on the grounds that an employer does not have to tolerate hate speech. That's the Bible. Similarly, Catholic adoption agencies have been closed because they refused to work with gay couples. A religious photographer was sanctioned because she declined to photograph a lesbian wedding. Even behavior outside of the workplace can get you in trouble. Crystal Taylor, an administrator at the University of Toledo, was fired because she wrote a letter to the editor of a newspaper objecting to the comparison of the gay movement to the civil rights movement. Other examples abound, and making sexual orientation a suspect classification would ensure that such cases become ubiquitous. The tax exemptions of traditional religious congregations would be in jeopardy. So, okay, there's obviously a lot more that could be said about this, but Brian encouraged me, and I certainly agree, to leave 15 to 20 minutes for some colloquy here. So please, I invite your questions, comments, criticisms. Eric?